Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. All right, well, let's start out this week with a study on antioxidants. And, of course, so the key antioxidant, or one of the main antioxidant enzyme systems in your body, revolves around the production of glutathione. Glutathione is it's especially an inside-the-cell antioxidant. And by that I mean you can take glutathione as a dietary supplement, and it will work in between cells. But glutathione does not cross cell membranes. Therefore, glutathione functionality as an antioxidant has to be built up from within the cells. So some of the precursor amino acids that make the antioxidant glutathione, cysteine and glycine, are the two that are the most important. Glutamate, which is another one, is a pretty glutamic acid, is, you know, in the diet in protein in general. So we want to focus generally on the intake of cysteine and glycine, which are also in the diet, but not as much, and are more difficult to get in. Anyway, this particular study was done using individuals where they fed the precursors, the precursor amino acids, and then tested to see if it could restore antioxidant status. And in this case, it was comparing diabetic patients to non-diabetics. Now, someone who's diabetic, obviously, their antioxidant system is invariably out of whack. That's partly how they got into the problem they're in. So whether it was through dietary abuse or some other issue, especially with type 2 diabetics, of course, then we have a situation where we have a lot of malfunction that's kind of locked in place, along with depleted antioxidants. So resurrecting the levels of the antioxidant defense system is, of course, crucial to getting a person out of this. So what they did, this was, you know, a people study. They fed them the glutathione precursors, and acetylcysteine, and glycine, and they found that by doing that, they could actually restore the glutathione levels in these compromised adults back to the level of younger, healthy adults simply from antioxidant precursor supplementation. Well, that's great news, really, for everyone. So, you know, I mean, a lot of the antioxidants we take, whether it be vitamin E, lipoic acid, many of the antioxidants, they work synergistically. One of their main functions is to help recycle glutathione into an active state. So glutathione, as it's used, kind of goes into an inactive form, and then it gets re-energized back into a antioxidant form. And that's the function of a lot of antioxidants, is to do this. But the question is, well, do you have enough even in the first place? And so by supplementing the precursor nutrients, say N-acetylcysteine and glycine, you can significantly enhance your antioxidant status. This is now proven in compromised adults who are type 2 diabetic, and it shows you can actually get this antioxidant reserve back up to the youthful level. That's really fantastic news, because your antioxidant reserves are part and parcel of your health. All right, next study. A lack of deep sleep is associated with high blood pressure. All right, so normally when we're thinking of high blood pressure, we're thinking of problems in the circulatory system. But what we don't think about a lot of times is, well, what is the circulatory system compensating for that would make the blood pressure go up? So, I mean, your doctor, you know, they're thinking, oh, they got weak kidneys. Maybe this person eats too much salt, not enough potassium or magnesium, or there's plaque in the arteries. You know, they're always looking at, you know, as soon as the blood pressure goes up, there must be some problem with the circulatory system. A lot of times there's other kinds of problems that the circulatory system is actually trying to compensate for, because the circulatory system is trying to deliver oxygen and nutrition to the small areas of your body. And if there's a problem getting circulation to an area, or if there are things congesting the circulation, or, you know, there's just many different things that could be happening here, the blood pressure will rise up in an effort to push the nutrition where it needs to go. It's actually, you might say, a healthy response to some kind of a problem. Of course, doctors never differentiate between an actual problem in the structure and of the circulatory system compared to some other problem that's causing blood pressure to elevate. That's why I like to say we don't have thinking doctors half the time. They don't explore the individual patient in front of them. They just automatically assume that high blood pressure is bad and that you need to medicate it down. Of course, in my experience, most of the time, the reason blood pressure goes up initially is trying to fix some other problem by enhancing circulation. And that's causing the pressure to rise to get the nutrition where it needs to go. So a lot of times we're not even addressing the source of the problem. We just try to knock down the blood pressure number with a drug. Nevertheless, one of the things that was just discovered in this is a lack of deep sleep, what they call the slow wave stage 3-stage 4 sleep. There's not much of a distinction anymore between stage 3 and 4, but it's the deeper sleep that you would get into. And if you don't get into that deeper sleep, you definitely have elevated risk for higher blood pressure. Now, there could be lots of different reasons for that. Your body is cleaning up the inflammation of the day. It's trying to repair things, recover things, reset things. Basically, you could say that if you get enough restorative deep sleep, your circulatory system has a chance to clean itself up and get itself reset for the next day. And a lack of that deep sleep means your circulatory system is like getting started with a kitchen full of dirty dishes, and you got problems right off the bat, even before you've cooked a meal. And that's basically what it says. There's no making up for a lack of deep sleep. So, you know, one of the ways to help your blood pressure then, obviously, is to see what you can do to get a better night's sleep. Nutrients like magnesium, glycine, which I just mentioned to help build up the glutathione, but glycine is a relaxant neurotransmitter in your brain, melatonin. There's lots of options for sleep. You're just trying to find something that you notice. You sleep better. You feel more refreshed. This could be inflammation reduction during sleep. You know, lately I've been using blueberries with people, blueberry extracts to help them sleep, and I find that helps. It just helps relax the inflammation in the brain. It's not even a sedative. So you got lots of things you can try, and of course for you, it may be different than it is for somebody else. Not everybody responds to the same sleep nutrients the same way. You don't want to be groggy and hungover and headachy from whatever your strategy to help you sleep is. If you're doing that, it's too much for you, whatever it happens to be, or not quite right. You try something different until you find a combination that helps you to sleep deeper. And, of course, doing consistent exercise, especially aerobics, helps you restore sleep rhythms and patterns. So, you know, it's an integrated approach. But the point is that when you sleep better, your blood pressure will be better. Fat buildup on the outside of the heart predicts problems in the arteries. Well, this is part of an emerging body of science, and both the heart itself and your arteries, especially your large arteries around your heart, have a fatty layer around the outside of them that is supposed to be there. It is part of the structure of them. It kind of like provides insulation on the one hand, but it's a structural fat that is actually supposed to be there. However, that fat can become fatty, and I call this fat in all the wrong places. Now, it's obviously more likely to grow when your body is getting fat. So we know, for example, that when your waistline is larger than if you multiply your waistline times 2, and your height should not be any more than that. That's not a flat stomach by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a point. Statistically, we know that the disease processes associated with being overweight are kicked into gear. And one of these things, of course, is that as you can, you can't keep storing the fat in your stomach, so then it builds up in your liver, then it gets into the arteries and organs and tissues. Well, it's not just in the arteries or in the heart that the problem exists. It's actually more of a problem to have the fat on the outside of the arteries or in the outside of the heart, because that is not just a structural fat, it's a communication fat. And when it gets fatty, it gets really inflamed in that fat, and that sends inflammatory signals into the heart and into the arteries, and that's actually a major risk factor for cardiovascular problems. So this study here is one that is showing that the fat, just more proof that this is going on as a major risk factor. And you know, we've got to get this problem under control. Now, it's clearly about inflammation associated with fat. So the nutrients like DHA, blueberries, grapeseed extract, tocotrienols, quercetin, curcumin, you know, pantothene, acetyl-carnitine, you got so many options here. The point is you get a program going where you have better circulation, you're losing weight consistently and steadily over time, not hitting plateaus and going backwards, and now your body will tend to clear up the worst fat first. So you'll lose fat from around your arteries before you lose fat from your stomach even, which is a good thing for you even if you don't think your stomach is shrinking. So your body always likes to get rid of the worst fat first. It'll take fat out of your liver before it'll take it out of your belly. It's like, let's get rid of it in all the wrong places first, then we'll work on the right place to have it if you're going to have some and try to get that down. So that's why you want to be on one of these consistent programs. So, you know, this is huge, though, because it's what happens when you start building up fat around the outside of the arteries and the outside of the heart is it creates an inflammatory system to the heart and to the arteries where macrophages infiltrate into this fat, start generating inflammatory signals. This uses up your friendly nitric oxide, and now you have high blood pressure, you have other problems, not what you want. Not a good thing for you. So pay attention. Fat around the outside of the arteries, actually more problematic to driving the plaquing process inside the arteries than fat inside the arteries is. All right. Aerobics beats weightlifting for loss of belly fat. This is a head-to-head competition. This was done by researchers at Duke University in an 8-month study. Aerobic participants, they took basically not active people anywhere from the ages of 18 to 70. And they had some of them run 12 miles jogging, 3 sessions, totaling 12 miles a week, compared to 3 heavy weightlifting sessions per week. So they were pushing them, you know, fairly hard in each of these sessions of exercise, and then comparing the aerobics to the weight training and seeing which is superior. And they found out that those who did the aerobics lost more weight and lost more belly fat. Now, I'm, of course, a big fan for either form of exercise and actually for both forms of exercise. But clearly, aerobic conditioning had the higher level of ability. And so not only should you be aware of that, but you should actually do it. I know there's some of you out there who maybe don't think you're fit enough, so you have to gradually work back into it. Of course, I've given many suggestions about getting a better response to running. I think one of the key things that you can do for your own health, besides actually doing the exercise, is making sure you get a good response to the exercise. So we'll, you know, use nutrition to support that. I wrote about that in my running tips article. But that's the kind of thing that, you know, makes a big difference. Don't ever want to forget to do your aerobics. All right, vitamin C helps children with asthma. This is asthmatic children between the ages of 7 and 10 given a measly 200 milligrams of vitamin C per day for 6 weeks. The 7 to 8-year-olds responded best because their problem wasn't so locked in. 37% increase in their air volume. Now, if they had sensitivity to molds and dampness, the benefit was reduced a little bit. And in children who were 9 and 10, who had been exposed to molds and dampness, they still got a 21% improvement from vitamin C in their air breathing, but had more issues, meaning there's other things going on besides just a vitamin C deficiency. A lot of times, of course, vitamin C is synergistic with flavonoids, so we typically use with children, you know, grapeseed extract or quercetin and magnesium. Those are typical ones, B vitamins in general, just your basics. But then sometimes, you know, especially if you notice that they're mold sensitive or damp sensitive, flaring up the symptoms, you know, it rains a lot in the spring and the fall, symptoms get worse, that kind of thing. Heaven forbid you have an asthmatic child living in a moldy room, not good. But anyway, you know, then you have cross-reactivity to the yeasts, usually caused originally by antibiotics. Of course, antibiotics, another risk factor for asthma. So there's a lot of things you can do as a parent so that you're not just putting your kids on medication and hoping for the best and not really solving their underlying problem. Part of it is the depletion of the antioxidants. Something as simple as 200 milligrams of vitamin C with a very, very good health benefit. All right, we've got green tea polyphenols enhancing protein metabolism and reducing tumors. Oh, green tea. We've got to love the green tea. It's one of those nifty little nutrients. Of course, quercetin is a component of green tea, as is the epogallocatechin gallate, EGCG, is kind of the active component of the polyphenol of green tea. Here it is. They were testing individuals with an inability to metabolize protein. And I found this study interesting because, you know, I talk a lot about whey protein, and some people, you know, they just feel great on whey protein. Other people, they feel tired. They get hungrier eating whey protein. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. And it appears that they may have a deficiency of an enzyme called glutamate dehydrogenase, which actually breaks down the protein so it can be used properly. Well, lo and behold, green tea compensates for this problem with this enzyme. Even if you have a complete malfunction of the enzyme, it seems to compensate for it. That's pretty amazing. So if you are someone who's trying to incorporate a higher protein diet but just don't feel as good as you might on it, try some green tea with the higher protein meal, especially your breakfast. See if that can be involved. Very interestingly, these same researchers found that this glutamate dehydrogenase enzyme that isn't working right is actually prone to being hijacked in the case of tumor growth, so that the cancer can use protein for itself. And interestingly, the catechins of green tea prevent the cancer from using the protein, prevents the cancer from the abnormal use of this enzyme to feed cancer growth. So here, once again, you have this wonderful intelligence of nutrition, where you see that a nutrient can help correct a human inability to metabolize protein so the human being can get more out of the protein, where at the same time, using the same enzyme system, but intelligently, it prevents the cancer from grabbing the protein to feed its growth. Wow. Holy smolies. Well, if we had a drug that did that, of course, it would be considered a Nobel Prize for the discovery. You know, I mean, Mother Nature's already got it. All right, chocolate reduces cardiovascular disease and stroke. The British Medical Journal is jumping on the chocolate bandwagon, publishing a study that shows the highest levels of chocolate consumption compared to no chocolate resulted in a 37% reduction in cardiovascular disease and a 29% reduction in stroke based on a meta-analysis of 7 studies that qualified for their analysis involving 114,000 people. I guess the take-home message is that if you like chocolate and it doesn't keep you up at night from its caffeine intake, then maybe it's not such a bad way to get some of your antioxidants. Obviously, dark chocolate has more compared to sugar-laden chocolate, although, quite frankly, this study, it was just chocolate. They weren't even evaluating quality in chocolate to get that. So you can probably hypothesize that if someone were eating, you know, minimally processed dark chocolate, they'd get a much better statistical benefit in terms of cardiovascular disease and stroke reduction. Chocolate, better than statins, by statistics. That's right, 37% risk reduction in cardiovascular disease. Statins only give you a 35% risk reduction. That's with the data being massaged. This is just chocolate data. You know, maybe we should have a $20 billion government-subsidized chocolate handout instead of a fraudulent statin industry. Okay, last study this week. Cardiologists embrace natural methods to help lower blood pressure. This is coming from the University of Rochester Medical Center in their cardiology unit. And these doctors are studying nutrition primarily because patients come into them with bagfuls of nutrients. And so they're like saying, well, hey, you know, well, guess what? Docs, maybe some of this stuff actually works. In fact, we're particularly fond of coenzyme Q10. They're calling it a shining star among supplements. Quote, coenzyme Q10 has a pretty profound effect on blood pressure, says Kevin Wolf, the study co-author. I mean, they look at things like potassium, calcium, vitamin D, folic acid, fish oil, garlic, flavonoids, high-fiber diet. I mean, they didn't mention magnesium and tocotrienols and a bunch of other things. But, hey, at least they're this is mainstream people treating people in outpatient clinics, noticing people are coming in, and maybe some of the supplements might actually help them. You know, blood pressure issues, it's not necessarily that you're just lacking a supplement. I mean, you've got to fix the problems. You've got to get to the source of problems. You've got to get your body working in harmony with itself. There's a lot of things you can do. But certainly, you need basic nutrition for your blood pressure, whether you're just doing potassium and magnesium, maybe some B vitamins, some CoQ10. Those are just your very basics, a high-fiber diet. I mean, this stuff is simple, but it's very, very powerful nutrition. And some doctors, anyway, are not only catching on, but even writing articles about it, at least explaining. You know, they're not just ruling it out. I mean, we go through different phases with the medical community. About 15 years ago, they said, hey, you know, this was the kind of article that you'd see the journals would be saying, well, you know, you better not just discount out of fact, you know, that we've got, you know, half the population using alternative medicine. And if they show up and ask you a question and you just discount it out of hand, you know, maybe that's not so good. So then they kind of went through a phase for a while of starting to look at it, and then, you know, whoa, knee-jerk reaction, they just pulled back big time and started going after the vitamins, you know, as soon as the pharmaceutical companies regrouped to what was going on, they started attacking and even, you know, coming up with fraudulent vitamin E studies and everything else under the sun. You know, now it's kind of swinging, the pendulum's swinging back a little bit, a little crack in the door here. But I like to mention these kind of studies when they come about, because this is just mainstream doctors saying, hey, you know, let's integrate some nutrition along with what we're doing and let's hope for the best. There's certainly no harm and maybe some of these things might actually help. And that's, you know, some light shining at the end of the tunnel. Maybe one day we'll have integrated healthcare where we actually have doctors and alternative practitioners working side by side in some sort of utopian healthcare system. Wouldn't that be the day? I laugh because many of you out there are probably saying, yeah, why don't we all do that? Well, it's called money. And the pharmaceutical interests don't want anything to do with people, number one, getting better, or number two, sharing their profit-generating systems, which are all drug-dependent. Drugs give more side effects, take more drugs, on and on we go. All right, so let's see what we have. Yes, your questions for the week. First one comes from Sue. Says, I wake up every morning at 4 a.m. with a racing feeling. I thought it was my blood sugar being low, but it doesn't matter how or when I eat in relationship to bed, and eating a little something when I wake up doesn't really help. Is there another reason for this? It is somewhat amazes me that it is always 4 a.m. regardless of when I go to sleep. Well, I always like to say, Sue, in my experience, and I think there's some, you know, Eastern medicine stuff. There's some Eastern medicine circadian rhythm data, but really the science of circadian rhythms. In my thing is 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. is your liver time in the morning. And so when you're waking up between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., your liver is processing toxins, processing waste products, and generally, this is my experience, mind you, but generally when you're waking up in a timed way, a metabolically timed pattern, it's especially 2 to 4, it's your liver. Liver is not able to do house cleaning adequately, starting to panic a little bit. So you start to release adrenaline. The liver is not really up to snuff. Sometimes it's because of your blood sugar. But, you know, you just told me that wasn't really the case. So then normally it's toxins. So what I usually do is have somebody, say, take daily balancer during the day, anywhere from 3 to 6. Not at night in this situation, because if you take it at night, it just you want less toxic stuff to do. So you take it during the day so that there's less house cleaning to do at night. If you take it at night and don't take it during the day, you just have more house cleaning, and you're already not doing that very well. So, you know, the goal is to kind of have less to do. But I find that to be the number one reason for that, Sue. Frank says, I get dizzy when I roll over in bed or if I turn sharply. I had a bad bout with the flu, and this symptom is lingering, although I no longer feel sick at all. Do you know why I feel this way? My doctor has checked my ears and said he does not see a problem with them, although my balance does feel a bit off to me. Well, generally, Frank, I mean, this can happen, of course, to people independent of an illness. But when you have an illness, your lymphatic system, which is where a lot of your immune activity comes from to fight something, has more to do. And so you're more prone to lymphatic congestion during an illness. That's why people often feel headachy and run fevers because they have too much toxins and feel like they've been run over by the Mack truck. You know, I mean, I like to say, if you don't know what fibromyalgia is, and you can't seem to relate to somebody who's got a bad case of fibromyalgia, just think back to one time when you were really sick with the flu and you felt like you were run over by a Mack truck. And that's how a person with really bad fibro feels every day, even though they're not sick, you see. It's backed up, congested, toxic lymph. But when you go through this acute lymphatic toxic problem, and then you get over it, but you're not quite over it. So what happens is the shoulder area swells, the lymphatics swell, push pressure up into the head, which now the ears, even though there's nothing structurally wrong with them, they actually can't drain properly. So you get pressure back up on the ear balance center, and then when you roll over in bed, of course it's worse at night when you're trying to sleep because that's when your lymph system is most active, or even when you turn sharply. The pressure dynamics in your ear is being adversely influenced by the lymph system, which is still problematic. So I would use some Immune Plus, possibly some Repair Plus, higher doses for a while, you know, a heaping tablespoon of Immune Plus, maybe three times a day, up to six or more, or Repair Plus to help eat away at the lymph congestion. This will clear it out. You're not really well, Frank, until you can actually do your aerobics. And you may not have been doing any in the first place, but you've got to get yourself aerobically fit following an illness before you're really truly over it. So there's a lot of lingering things that go on besides just the acute feeling of being sick. And in your case, your dizziness is a lymphatic congestion. All right, Jill says, I diet really well for several weeks, and then I break down, eat everything in sight for a few days, then I get back on my diet. It seems to happen at the time of my ovulation and especially at the time of my period. Is there any way I can stop this? It really bothers me and prevents me from losing the 15 pounds I am trying to lose since the birth of my third child. Prior to that, I never had trouble with weight or getting my weight off following pregnancy. I'm 35 and otherwise in pretty good health. All right, so yes, each additional child you have, it's not like 1 plus 1 plus 1. It's kind of logarithmic. It's like 1 plus 5 plus 20. You know, it's more stress to your body, and so as the pregnancies go by, it is not uncommon for changes in the monthly hormonal pattern to develop that weren't there prior to those pregnancies. That's just the way it goes. It's wear and tear. So now, both at ovulation for you and at your menstrual cycle, the demand for energy to run these things is so intense it's causing you to become hypoglycemic and eat everything in the house. So one of the things you want to do is be on a very high protein diet right around ovulation and the week before your menstrual cycle. So I'd go up to a gram of protein a day per pound of body weight, or at least 3/4 of your ideal body weight in grams of protein per day at those times of the month. You don't have to eat that way all month, but once you start, you have such a high demand for protein that if you don't keep it up that high, your body will take apart your neurotransmitters in your brain to give your female system protein, and then, of course, you feel crummy. It's just a physiologic demand. So try protein to begin with, and then other adrenal support, pantothene, CoQ10, vitamin C, female plus. Do enough adrenal support, Jill, along with the higher protein diet, and I'll bet you won't have that problem. All right, John says, I have a lot of white spots on my fingernails. Does that mean something? Yes, John, it does, actually. The traditional deficiency symptom of white spots on the fingernails has been traced to zinc. Remember, your fingernails are a fast-growing protein structure. So when you see abnormalities in your fingernails, it reflects protein abnormalities in your body. So like the deep vertical ridges are usually a lack of protein and or a lack of iron. And the white spots are typically zinc, although I found MSM sulfur also can cause white spots. That's why I actually designed the Strengthener Plus product that has both zinc and sulfur in it. I used the original design of that product, believe it or not, John, was to correct white spots on the fingernails. Because if you can correct those, you're correcting an inability of protein to form structure throughout your body, not just your white spots and your fingernails. So, and a lot of people who exercise, putting their body under more demand, will see the white spots even appear during the exercise, meaning the exercise needs more nutrition to keep up with it. All right, Beth says, I have chronic diarrhea and have tried many digestive products, acidophilus, natural germ killers. I've had alternative and comprehensive stool testing done, and nothing much comes up that indicates I have a problem in my digestive tract, certainly one that warrants this. Can stress cause this problem? I am under very high stress, and I do think it is related, but my doctor doesn't think it would cause chronic diarrhea. Do you have any suggestions? Well, I mean, it sounds, Beth, like you've actually done a fairly good job of, you know, trying some of the variables that might be going on inside your digestive tract, all of which could be possible with diarrhea. So the things like the acidophilus, germ killers, digestive enzymes, those are all good things to try. There's a lot of good digestive products. Sometimes they will help. And even if you get the other part of whatever your problem here with stress solved, maybe they would still be helpful to help. But the number one reason for ongoing diarrhea in the absence of something in your digestive tract is, in fact, stress chemicals banging into the outside of your digestive tract where substance P releases, creates inflammation. And then the essentially what happens is that the lining of your digestive tract spasms. You know, just like you can get tight muscles in the top of your neck or something, you get these tight digestive muscles, and they spasm, and then instead of having motility, where things naturally pulse along based on the relaxation side of your nervous system, now you've got tightness in there, and the digestive tract becomes like a slide or an open chute where you don't have any wavy motion anymore. You just got tightness, and it, whoosh, stuff just goes right through. The only way to really know, besides the fact of what I maybe just described to you, we use enteric-coated peppermint oil for that problem, and it is a miracle. Enteric-coated peppermint oil is the single best antispasmodic for the digestive tract, Beth. And you can try that, and if that's your problem, your diarrhea will go away quickly. It's very good for that. Ethan says, I have really bad jock itch. Nothing seems to help. I have pimples on my rear end, which I don't know if they are related or not. I do eat too much junk and probably a few too many beers every now and then, but cutting them out or eating much better does not clear up the problem or seem to improve it. When I do more aerobic exercise, it actually seems to make matters worse. Any idea why? Is this contagious? Well, most often, Ethan, I mean, we all, just so you understand, on every skin surface of our body, we have bacterial and fungal signatures normally living in peaceful harmony on the surfaces of our body. So we all have germs, and it's varied from person to person. It's all like a different germ signature that we have. Most of it is friendly or just normal or not pathogenic. But when we start having skin problems, psoriasis, dermatitis, itching, etc., a lot of times that barrier is compromised, especially if you scratch your skin and open up a wound or something, then you kind of make matters worse. But jock itch, specifically. Jock itch is almost always fungal, in my opinion, and based on my experience. And you're saying nothing seems to help, so you've probably tried some of the over-the-counter jock itch type cream things. And the pimples, of course, would be a pimples on the rear end. Typically, stuff is crawling out your rectum and crawling all over everywhere and getting things sort of imbalanced. So it's kind of an imbalance issue, Ethan. So even though, you know, eating less junk and not having beers isn't cleared up, that just means the problem's established. It doesn't mean that the junk and the beers aren't fueling it. It just means that even if you quit taking them, you quit pouring gasoline on the fire, the fire's still burning. Okay, fine, the fire's still burning. So, I do suggest acidophilus in this situation. Maybe that would be enough to help you. Topically, I like shea butter for the male organs, and iodine, topical iodine. Neither one of them are very harsh. Both of them are good germ killers and heal the skin. So almost always shea butter applied topically will get rid of the itching. And iodine can put on once or twice a week, put about 5 or 10 drops of, what we use, the Iosol, and just rub it around. It'll soak in pretty fast. Usually iodine is really good for the testicles, so it's not a problem. It helps metabolize androgens properly and helps not build up estrogen in the wrong place. So those are good suggestions. I used this product. One time a guy called me and he said, basically the same thing you're saying. And this was like, must have been 20 years ago. And we used this stuff called Losan, which is very strong antifungal. I talked about it I think I've talked about it recently. But it was originally designed to be used diluted as a vaginal douche. Very, very strong germ killer, probably the strongest one. So I said, you know, because guys don't want to dilute things. They said, well, just, you know, wipe some on and wipe some on, it'll kill anything you got, which is true. But the guy called me back about 3 weeks later. He said, dude, what did you do to me? He said, I put that stuff on and it burned like crazy and my skin turned all red and it peeled. And then I was better a week later. But it was a week of torture. Well, okay, so he killed the germs. There was like weeds in the lawn. It all sloughed off. It was very painful. So I don't normally tell people to do that anymore. But that's another option you might want to try it diluted if you ever use it, Ethan. But you got something there you got to kill. But, you know, getting the butt pimples, you know, that's, you know, you've got an imbalance in your lower colon, so you got to work on that problem too. You can't just knock things out and not address the source of it, because that's usually what the source of it is. Is it contagious? Sure. It's contagious, either way. So iodine after sex for both men and women applied directly to the genital area for either sex is a very good germ killer. And so it's great in that regard. Very high uptake into the female or male hormonal system and very helpful for either sex besides being a germ killer. So that's, one thing that can be done to help reduce transmission. A lot of people with candida give it back and forth and on around we go. All right, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week. I'll be back next week with, as always, another Weekly Wellness Update podcast. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.